Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for dropping in tonight at the Sydney Institute, where Judith Pugh makes a welcome return. The last time she was here, Judith spoke about her memoir of the 1970s, Unstill Life. And today she's appearing here on the occasion of having completed her PhD thesis, which is soon to be examined at the La Trobe University, concerning the Commonwealth Arts Advisory Board, which existed from 1912 until 1973. But tonight Judith Pugh is going to talk on the topic Robert Menzies and the Visual Arts. Judith, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you, Gerard. General art and cultural histories and Menzies' meticulous biographer, Alan Martin, begin a discussion of the Prime Minister's involvement in the visual arts with his initiative for an Australian Academy of the Arts. Martin does not follow the trend, but most historians go on to conflate Menzies' embrace of British culture with a rejection of the value of Australian modern painting and any European or American influence, some very unfortunate remarks he made in private correspondence, Australia's entry into the Venice Biennale and the Tate Gallery exhibitions while he was Prime Minister, to dismiss Menzies' interest in the visual arts. I want to begin by painting a picture. It is early morning in the small country town, Japaret, in Victoria. The air is cool, but the sun is warming the buildings, the trees, the fences, warming both in temperature and in colour, that slow gild that touches each element of a place before the brightness of the day. The year is 1899, and James Menzies is sorting deliveries to his general store, and his youngest son, Robert, 5 years old, comes into the shop from the residence. There are colourful printed posters on the wall advertising brands of food and household goods, and the shelves themselves are an exhibition of commercial art. Far fewer small packages than fill today's supermarkets, big tins and bags of produce, elaborately decorated. James takes up a tin of biscuits. Perhaps it's Swallow and Ariel. Look at that. See how the artist has captured the bird in flight, managed to detail its feathers. This is an enthusiasm of James because he is a trained coach painter. Such painting required meticulous attention to detail and a capacity to produce an advertisement, written or drawn, that conveyed a message in an instant. James was brilliant at this. A friend of the entrepreneur Hugh McKay, James Menzies had christened and then painted the Sunshine Harvester in one of the most memorable images of that era. Alan Martin explains that the Menzies moved to Japaret because James was an obsessive man who worked all hours. His wife was concerned for his health in the cold of Ballarat, and they took on the general store in a building where an uncle produced the paper. The dry Wimmera climate suited James, the family prospered, and James was elected to the Victorian Parliament. I'm not keen on speculation in history, but I'm willing to bet on my little image. James Menzies training his alert and intelligent little boy because one can see the effect of Robert Menzies' visual formation. We know Menzies loved the work of Arthur Streeton. The cool Wimmera mornings develop into high blue skies above golden grasses. The haze of summer heat turns the morning detail into impressionism. We know that Menzies complained of distortion in modernism, not its subject matter. And while uninterested in abstraction, he failed to see the point, He looked for accurate representation in non-abstract painting. He became a lawyer, where recall and evidence are rigorously tested, and he became a parliamentarian at a time when wit and repartee were crucial for success. He was born a citizen of Britain, and just as he turned 7, the British colony in which he lived became part of the Australian nation. I'm dwelling on this because much of the criticism directed at Menzies' taste in art suggests that his embrace of British heritage, together with his enthusiasm for Australian Impressionism, especially Streeton, implies a commitment to un-Australian 18th century colonial values. This is more than just an occasional remark, it is an embedded view of the man. It is not just a general attitude that his views were conservative. When one of my friends posted a note about this talk on Facebook, a response remarked on his promotion of Aryan ideas. And his ideas of art have been described as fascist. A widely held position is that Menzies actively campaigned to prevent the acceptance of modern art in Australia, and that when Prime Minister, he acted against modern artists. Another widely held view is that the Prime Minister Gough Whitlam was a devotee of the arts in general and visual arts in particular, and that his enthusiasm led to an increase in spending on the arts, especially visual arts, and that without his initiative, we'd have no National Gallery of Australia. As so often in history, these ideas do not bear scrutiny. Menzies was an enthusiast for visual art. His close friends were artists. He collected, he visited exhibitions and galleries at every opportunity. As a parliamentarian and prime minister, he promoted... Thanks, Gerard. Where's page 3? Here. He promoted Australian art. He learned from his artist friends. His government pumped money into the visual arts through a variety of means. He shrewdly appointed trained professionals as advisors and acted on their advice. And without his initiative, we might have no National Gallery. Gough Whitlam did not hang around with artists. His intellectual interests before he became Prime Minister were in the classics and in literature. He was reluctantly persuaded to take an interest in the arts, and he appointed non-artists to the Australia Council, resulting in the continuation of systems and policies that his own party's strategy had sought to end. In the last analysis, these impressions are the result of extremely successful public politics. By this I mean that in the case of Menzies, he and his advisers, accepting that they would forever be characterised as conservative men in suits, did nothing to dispel that illusion. While expanding visual arts funding in the most imaginative ways, they accepted the characterisation of dull, retrograde officials because this protected the programme. The campaign to show artists supporting Whitlam's election was developed in order to turn a negative image of the ALP from an incompetent pack of institutionalised warring bullies into a lively, engaged and modern political party. Whitlam did not ever understand the policy that underlay the campaign. He at first refused to adopt the campaign, and then, having accepted its efficacy, ignored its basis in structure and took to the adulation of openings and opening nights. I know this because I designed the campaign. The historical narrative mainly focuses on the latter part of the 20th century. I've remarked that Robert Menzies spent much of his leisure in the art world with his artist friends. Another prime minister, Andrew Fisher, also hung around with artists, and it was the structure established by Fisher that allowed Menzies to expand funding for the visual arts and to plan the National Gallery. An account of the Australian art and the visual arts begins with the artist Tom Roberts and with a painting. The Commonwealth Parliament met for the first time in the temporary national capital, Melbourne. Tom Roberts painted the opening ceremony in the exhibition building. His triumphant painting of formal British Australia is known as The Big Picture. It is perhaps the best known 20th century Australian painting. He says, "I was able to see that immense gathering of people from all over Australia and from many parts of the world. It was very solemn and great. The heads on the floor looked like a landscape stretching away." The grandeur of the picture conveys Robert's emotional commitment to the occasion. A document, yes, and something more. The royalty and its suite of governors, of states and the members, democracy with the people. That's the empire, and all this meets under the one roof, And that's what I'm painting. He was also painting the lobbying opportunity of all time. Robert's commission, by a group of businessmen, not the government, was a happy coincidence of self and public interest. It offered the opportunity to introduce his idea that the Commonwealth begin a program to memorialise eminent Australians. The Speaker of the House made Roberts an honorary member of the mess in the Victorian Parliament House, where the Commonwealth Parliament sat during the search and location for the establishment of the national capital. He judiciously included newspaper proprietors and representatives of each religious denomination to fill his gallery of miniatures. Their sittings, too, normalised the idea to people who formed public opinion that there be a memorial project. His subjects could imagine themselves memorialised. This alone rendered opposition to the idea unlikely. And when the memorial's proposal was brought to the Parliament, it was familiar to everyone of influence in the country. Roberts also lobbied directly. In March 1910, he wrote from London to the Prime Minister, Alfred Deakin, who had become a close friend as he was painted for the big picture. Roberts argued, "Now this is important and must appeal to you, and it is a duty of the present for the future. I don't need to press this on you or say more than, what would America give for authentic records of its founders, and that there is no time to lose?" He went on, "After a lot of thinking, I make this appeal to you to act in the matter without any delay." Deakin lost an election on the 13th of April that year to the Australian Labor Party, led by Andrew Fisher. Roberts wrote to Deakin, commiserating with him and going on to say, "About my last letter to you and the portraits. Still, I am glad to have made the offer and hope still that you will have the idea carried out if in some other way. You owe it to those who come after." Deakin took the matter further. On December the 2nd that year, Roberts wrote in reply to a letter from Deakin, "It is clearly that his proposal was not simply to get work for himself. Many thanks for the copy of Mr. Fisher's note. Longstaff seems about to return to see his father. This would be a great chance for the scheme to be commenced at once. I haven't written to Mr. Fisher, as I could not do so more strongly than I did to you, and if you can be of one mind in this matter, it will be good." Another relationship in the small social field that was the Melbourne art world carried the idea forward. Andrew Fisher, now Prime Minister, discussed the idea not only with Deakin, but probably with other artists now well known, including his close friend, Hugh Patterson. Fisher's office was next door to the Grosvenor Chambers at 9 Collins Street, built as artists' studios by Patterson's brother Charles, which housed many artists over time. So a bipartisan policy was adopted when, on the 22nd of December 1911, the Executive Council of the just 10-year-old Commonwealth of Australia resolved to form a committee to consult and provide advice in reference to the expenditure of votes for the historic memorials of representative men. The advice was to be provided to the Parliament. The members of that committee were, and still are, the Prime Minister, the President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Vice President of the Federal Executive Council, the Leader of the Opposition in the House of Representatives, and the Leader of the Opposition in the Senate. The programme of memorials was the trigger for extensive engagement with the Australian art with the visual arts, and the decision taken in its first meeting to commission portraits of every speaker, the Senate President, the Prime Minister, and the Governor-General, is still in force today. Australia has a history, I think unique, of funding the visual arts, a direct engagement between the state and art. At its second meeting, the Historic Memorials Committee decided to appoint a board of professionally trained artists to give them advice. It was this structure, a powerful bipartisan parliamentary committee, being advised by a group of artists, trained to look at art but also familiar with what we would now call industry practice, the business of art, that began the National Collection and, crucially, enabled Robert Menzies to use his enthusiasm for visual art to expand that industry. Almost as soon as he was appointed to the Commonwealth Art Advisory Board, member Gotta Mann shared a Sydney ferry ride with Fisher and pointed out that while the Memorials Project helped portrait painters, landscape painters were not being assisted. A competition to paint the Canberra site was promptly announced with a prize of about $30,000 in today's money. The board actually had no power to advise or the HMC to act on matters beyond memorials, but from the time of their appointment, the board accepted gifts, bought pictures and sculptures, funded and discussed with the Historic Memorials Committee, commissioned presentations, and lobbied for a national gallery. Alan Martin describes Menzies' first visit to Britain and quotes his very experiential discovery of the place and the culture through his visually oriented diary, and commentators who take this to mean his connection, his sense of enthusiasm, was inappropriate for a 20th century Australian. Another Australian with an interest in history, art and politics, a Communist Party member during the war years, an intellectual, having recorded his exploration of various ports en route to London, none of which stimulated illegal or even flamboyant behaviour, recounts that when his ship docked at Tilbury in 1948, I felt something had to be done to mark our arrival, so I went up to A deck and waited for a moment when none of the ship's officers was in sight, and clambered up the ladder of the main mast to the crow's nest to see the Thames estuary spread out before me on all sides and the city of London smokily in the distance. This was more than 10 years after Menzies' first visit, and after the abandonment of our troops in Singapore and in Greece during the Second World War had contributed to cynicism about our British connections. This account was written by Bernard Smith, the most sophisticated Australian analyst of history and culture in the 20th century. If Bernard Smith was affected in this way by the idea of Britain, acts to make it real, and happily reports his exultation, there must have been something in the sense of connection. That it gripped Menzies' imagination and shaped his political opinions is undeniable, but that it was an aberration, or that it was somehow wrong, seems obtuse and distracts from his analysis of his role in the arts during his prime ministership. On his return to Melbourne, Menzies, opening an exhibition, described his visits to galleries in the United Kingdom and Europe. He referred to singularly ill-drawn pictures he'd seen. This was to be his theme for many years. On returning from a further London trip, he established an Academy of Australian Art to promote standards in art. I'm not going to go into detail about that debate because it involves the helices in the crucible of the Melbourne art world of left, right, twined about modern traditional paintings and amateur professional authority. The dominant narrative of the art world in this period is about the Heidi Bohemians, about the struggle for acceptance of the modern artists associated with Heidi, in particular Sidney Nolan and Albert Tucker. For this reason, the broader church and Britishness of the art world in Australia is underestimated, and Menzies' promotion of the idea of academy is weighted with pompousness and rigidity. But the story is not as simple. The idea of what is modern becomes crucial here. What Menzies saw in paintings that used the ideas from Demoiselle d'Avignon, Picasso's crucial painting, and its cubist developments was a challenge to the very idea of representation. This is because that painting does challenge representation, and modernism, as Bernard Smith points out, is a critique of modernity. I will point out here that Menzies, even in the controversial speech he made when launching the Victorian Artists' Society Show annual exhibition in 1936, in which he complained of much modern art, was opening a show. He was in the art world. As Martin pointed out, his much became interpreted as all. But Menzies, the witty parliamentarian and lawyer, expected, it seems, to be debating and to have a robust but not angry debate. His responses to his critics in the letters column shows this, and that he was on familiar terms with the correspondence, and what is more, that he feels the criticism. I think the response backed him into a corner from which he emerged much later when tactful artists who supported modernism had spent time with him. His romantic view of art, albeit old-fashioned, did not prevent him from realising, eventually, that times and art had changed, and to appoint modern art supporters to the CAAB once the elderly members still act on it had died. The Academy debate coincided with the reinstatement of the CAAB HMC programme of commissions, which had been suspended in 1929 as the Great Depression began. Art, after all, is a luxury. On the 26th of April 1939, following the death of Joseph Lyons, Robert Menzies was elected leader of the UAP and became Prime Minister, and the next meeting of the HMC took place on the 6th of June 1939, about 5 or 6 weeks later. The committee agreed to recommend £1,000 be provided to acquire outstanding examples of work the board saw in galleries in accordance with the policy of encouraging Australian art. Now, program has only been reinstated a couple of years ago. There's already a budget for catching up on portraits that hadn't been done. But here is Menzies actually adding an extra £1,000, a lot of money in those days, for just simply general collecting. Funding for a national gallery was suggested by the CAB, and the Prime Minister, Colonel Bell, Mr. Curtin and Senator Collings expressed views supporting the idea of a National Gallery of Australian Art at Canberra. An insouciant notion, given the country was about to go to war, but the board and committee were looking to the peace. Menzies told the meeting that the question would be brought up at budget meetings. By the time arrangements were in place for a meeting in September 1941, Menzies had resigned the Prime Ministership. Arthur Fadden was Prime Minister, Indian the Chair, and the committee considering the matter of the gallery felt in the present circumstances it was desirable to defer action. In 1941, Curtin, present at the meeting, was still Leader of the Opposition. It seems that while he and Menzies shared an idea of the importance of art, Fadden did not. In a few weeks, Curtin would become Prime Minister. The HMC next met on the Thursday, the 17th of February 1944. Curtin in the chair, Menzies opposition leader. At the end of the meeting, Ashton made a case for a government architect to go abroad to study lighting and wall colours for a gallery. That's one of the CAAB members, Will Ashton. Both Curtin and Menzies commented that such a building should have distinctive architectural features, and the committee again decided to draw the attention of the government to the necessity for early planning of a national art gallery for Canberra. Item 6 was so remarkable that it's headlined in the minutes, underlined and in bold. Suggested portraits of two original lady members of the Federal Parliament. The Executive Council minute, announcing the establishment of the HMC in 1911, had declared that the memorials were to be of representative men. Then in August 1943, Dorothy Tangney, an ALP candidate, was elected to the Senate from Western Australia. At the same election, Enid Lyons, who had been widowed when her husband Joseph Lyons died in office in 1939, was elected to the House of Representatives as member for Darwin in Tasmania. Like her husband, Lyons represented the UAP, which is to become the Liberal Party. The opposition leader in the upper house, Senator Maclay, while not opposing the proposal to record the historical significance of the election of the first women members of Parliament, thought their painting could reasonably be postponed. This was not necessarily a device to delay the portraits. It was 1944, February, and Australia was still engaged in World War II. The Prime Minister responded by reminding the group that the Commonwealth already possessed a number of portraits which are part of the history of the Commonwealth, and he considered it appropriate for the committee to secure portraits of the original lady members, and added that he would prefer the item not be deferred. The decision was made, not only to paint the lady parliamentarians, but to have them painted by lady portrait painters. Mr. Menzies agreed. It was a historic event, and he added he too would prevent the item not be deferred. The records of the committee and board during the late 1940s and 50s demonstrate the disjunction between the modernists and their supporters who began to demand institutional attention and the advisers to the politicians who had brought the country through the Depression and the war. G.V.F. Mann was appointed in 1912 and remained on the board until 1948 when he died. Will Ashton was appointed in 1917, and he finally retired just before he died in, I think it's 63. Mann and Will Ashton can be argued to have remained too long on the board. However, I suggest that their interest in Australian impression and history allowed the politicians and the society with which they were dealing time to catch up with modern ideas. This lack of interest in the more contemporary art would have itself raised questions about the board's engagement with the art world. But once J.S. MacDonald was appointed to the board in 1948, its reputation was bound to be affected. I emphasise this because the notion of the board's conservatism reinforces inaccurate ideas about Robert Menzies and his board. My argument is that the board's first personnel were acceptably in tune with their times, but two members, although gradually broadening their attitudes, rather outlived those times. J.S. MacDonald, who happened to be a great friend of Menzies, but who was quite mad, an outdated aberration. He was appointed chair by Chifley. However, the advantage of the board's conservatism in a time of social change allowed it to persuade politicians and the public to build a national collection, that the nation needed a national gallery and should be planning for it even in wartime. And it also normalised the remarkable notion that the state had a role in stimulating the local art market. It should be remembered that elsewhere, national collections came to the modern state from royal collections after revolutions or by donations, either from monarchs, aristocrats, merchants, or industrialists. These collections were ordinarily put into the hands of external curators. In Australia, the state paid, and the state managed the collection directly until the National Gallery was established. The conservative of the purchases and the commissions in the late 40s assisted in rendering unremarkable what was in fact an unusual, if not radical, arrangement. Oddly enough, condescension and hostility to the Maud and Menzies is in general to the board as constituted after the period of death of Mann and MacDonald, which renders even more complex the task of untangling the motive for these attitudes. Menzies appointed his friend MacDonald chair when Gotterman died, but added two modern supporters, Darrell Lindsay and Robert Campbell. It was not until MacDonald died that he appointed two apparently dull practising artists who also supported modernism. Cleverly, he left the lovable old Will Ashton, a painter of seascapes, the last pre-war survivor, as chair. This effectively masked the attitudes of the rest of the board members. At this point, Robert Campbell had been putting together a touring exhibition. He had chosen from among the best-known contemporary Australian names William Dobell, Russell Drysdale, Lloyd Rees, Sidney Nolan, Donald Friend, Justin O'Brien, Jean Bellette, Constance Stokes, Arthur Boyd, and three abstract painters, Godfrey Miller, Frank Hinder, and Ralph Balson. Part of the coronation celebrations in London, the show was to tour major provincial galleries in the UK. The work of Nolan, Dobell, and Drysdale then went to Venice to represent Australia through the portal of the British entry in the 1954 Biennale. Menzies made absolutely no complaint about this exhibition. The new members were anxious about it, that is, Pratt and Dargy. I think not at the names, but at the response of the traditional art societies of which they were both members. And they were right. This was a time of change, and the Conservatives were unaware their time was almost over. They could make a fuss, and did. Unamused, they held protest meetings and wrote to the press. The president of the RAS, Mr. Eric Langer, said last night that the 12 artists selected all exhibited with the Contemporary Art Society or the Society of Artists. Speakers at the Royal Art Society's meeting called the paintings the worst ever gathered in one place and a deification of horror. No responses recorded from Menzies or the board. Lindsay's and Campbell and Dargy were used to controversy. I won't go into details, but this led to an unfortunate display at the 1958 Biennale, which has been seized upon by his critics to paint Menzies and the board as fascists. I mean this promoting Aryan ideals parallel with those of Hitler. I'm quoting somebody who's just recently written a PhD, well, not really, about 10 years ago, produced a PhD saying this. The same that was said of the Tate Show in 1963 and of the murals installed in Australia House. At this point, this is after the war, the Americans and the Soviet Union were at ideological war in the arts, the USA arts establishment and the government using market forces to promote action painting, abstract expressionism, as a sole form of acceptable art. The Soviets, socialist realism. This new ideology, the American ideology, affects analysis of Menzies' contribution, particularly by younger academics and writers. I'm not going to dwell on the details, but now simply outline Menzies' engagement and initiatives in the visual arts from the early 1960s. On the 31st of May 1955, a full morning meeting of the HMC with the full board considered the first redesign of the coat of arms, conducted the usual review of commissions and purchases, and again returned to the question of the gallery. Everyone agreed it should be established as soon as possible. Evatt, present leader of the opposition, also pointing out that the collection should be catalogued. The board meeting the previous day had considered all these matters and also met with the Secretary of the Department of Immigration to discuss the design of a stamp to commemorate the arrival of the 1 millionth post-war migrant and of the naturalisation certificate. The stamp design must symbolise the contribution of the new citizens to industry and culture, and that the motive of the assistance of new Australians in defence of Australia should be brought out. 10 years earlier, in letters to Lionel Lindsay, Menzies had made very unpleasant remarks about migrants. In 1955, he brought the expertise of the board to the stamp design and to the design of a naturalisation certificate. The design of a naturalisation certificate was required to be of the greatest possible significance, certificates to the new citizen have artistic merit to be dignified, and its official character should be apparent. This confirms Mendes' understanding of his own culture had altered. The board from this time was given responsibility by Menzies for art and design questions in all areas of Commonwealth activity, including, for example, the National Library and the Australian National University. On the 17th of October 1956, the HMC considered a redesign of the coat of arms by the artist Daphne Mayo. On this occasion, and when arranging commissions for Australia House, the board can be seen actively to look for women artists and be considering their work. They began to purchase work to decorate official residences and embassies and to commission murals in Australia House. A short story provides an insight into the careful politics of the board and Prime Minister. In an oral history interview much later with fellow Australian National Gallery board director, board member James Gleeson, Dargy relates the story of Dobell's portrait of Dame Mary Gilmore and the Historic Memorials Committee. Having encouraged Dame Mary to donate her picture, Dargy, on the way to the meeting with the committee, asked Robert Campbell if he thought Menzies, who was no particular fan of Dobell, would reject the painting. Campbell replied, "Of course not. Everyone knows it's Dobell's best portrait." When they arrived in the Prime Minister's room for the meeting, Evatt, leader of the opposition, asked why the portrait was there. Told it was recommended for the National Collection, Evatt said that everyone knows it's the worst portrait Dobell ever painted. Menzies then said, if the leader of the opposition opposed its acquisition, he had to concur. Thus Evatt, in his one intervention in the acquisition of Australian art for the National Collection, contradicted the mythology of his reputation as a great supporter of Australian art. Dargy goes on to remark to Gleeson that having lost the opportunity to have the painting accepted, he then for months had to put up with artists at openings abusing him for refusing it. The story emphasises that for Dargy and Gleeson, and for Menzies, the feelings or dignity were irrelevant to the long-term success of the project, that although the politicians had made a very regrettable decision in refusing their advice, the interests of Australian art were served by accepting the blame and bearing the label of reactionary, rigid conservative. This understanding and acceptance of political reality allowed the process of expanding the collection to proceed without attention being drawn to the resources it consumed, at a time when public funds were still paying for the Olympics, infrastructure such as interstate highways and the Snowy River Irrigation Scheme, and when public attention was focused on royal visits, the Davis Cup and Test cricket. The question arises as to why critics and the Academy do not at the time and do not now observe that from this point on the CAAB was supporting a fast-growing art economy. Menzies' biographers too do not discuss the extensive programme of exhibitions of Australian art travelling the world, or that he sought through the board to promote a high standard of execution of imagery by using its expertise to advise Commonwealth departments. These included the Postmaster General's Department, the Departments of Primary Industry, of Immigration. The delegation by Menzies, and the Department of Works, with which it installed murals in aircraft terminals in Sydney and Melbourne, and the National Capital Development Commission, with which it installed sculpture and murals throughout the ACT. It placed work in Commonwealth offices across Australia, actively inquiring and accepting gifts for a national collection. Menzies, like Andrew Fisher and Curtin, allowed the board to work in a grey constitutional area. While by the 1960s there was a budget allocation for promoting art, the courts had not entirely resolved questions as to the delegation of ministerial powers. Menzies, a constitutional lawyer, was well aware of this. The clearest indication that Menzies was prepared to accept modern art is that he delegated to the board his own ministerial authority to make contracts. This is demonstrated in the minutes of the board meeting on the 23rd of June 1961. In January that year, the board had raised not only the question of its members' expenses, but also a realistic budget for purchases and an efficient system for such purposes. Menzies gave them a budget. And then, in the note, the secretary says, the Prime Minister had agreed new principles which would have the effect of conferring on the board certain executive powers. Included in these were purchase of paintings for the National Collection and purchase and exhibitions. The amount allocated for exhibitions may be used at the discretion of the board to assist exhibitions going abroad or coming from overseas for circulation in Australia. Under this item, selection need not necessarily be made by the board. The board could consider each request and decide whether assistance should be made available and the extent of any such assistance. This delegation of Menzies, by Menzies, of certain executive powers was remarkable. Firstly, he had the confidence that his delegation would not be a legal or a political problem. That is, as a constitutional lawyer, he knew there was a risk in delegating his power to purchase, but stood by his political judgment. Secondly, he delegated this power despite, on previous occasions, having not accepted some appointments, recommendations for the purchase. He decided here to suspend his own judgment as to artistic style and to defer to the board's expertise. Menzies may not have wanted to collect avant-garde work, but he came to accept that all forms of contemporary art had validity and that his experts would choose, on technical grounds, the best work for the national collection. Inquiries to his daughter have revealed that he owned a Ray Cook, who was undeniably a modern artist. He delegated his purchasing power in a system that functioned on oral contracts, that is, the purchaser indicated a desire to buy the work, the seller agreed the work was sold. Tom Roberts suggested the memorials and lobbied for the idea while he painted what he called the big picture. I look at that picture of politicians and I think of lobbying, of careful politics, aiming for an outcome, achieving that outcome. I want to end the story with the story of a file. There's a small file in Sir William Dargie's papers in the Australian National Library. The date is 1971. There is a letter from the Commonwealth Department of Works to the young and not at all conservative artist John Fur Smith, requiring him to remove his murals at Tullamarine and Mascot airports and to return the fee he has been paid for them. The murals are not only not in accordance with the sketches approved by the architect and the committee, but images of dismembered aeroplanes are considered quite unsuitable for departure lounges. The second letter is to Dargie. The letter to Firth Smith is withdrawn. The Commonwealth will remove and store the murals at its own cost. They understand that to paint them over would not be in the interest of the Commonwealth. Dargie had communicated with the department, and the interest of the artist is made to seem consonant with the interest of the Commonwealth, which it manifestly was not. This is the result of Menzies delegating his authority and letting his appointed artists use their expertise. It shows his capacity to judge people and to act on principle and to allow the visual arts to expand. Paradoxically, the evidence of the success of his work is that it remains hidden. He and his advisers managed to work behind the scenes to subsidise the visual arts. By allowing their image to appear reactionary, they were able to engage with up-to-the-minute arts practice. Of course, Menzies and his advisers got on. Close personal connection, sharing the same social field, were then crucial to successful lobbying. Constant good manners, no public disagreement, and taking the long-term view. For the visual arts, the politics were crucial. Robert's painting is known as the big picture. When planning a campaign, it is as well to keep the big picture in mind.
And now we come to question discussion. We've got till around the top of the hour. So this comment that, well, I should say firstly that I recall that when I was in Canberra in the last year of the Whitlam government, that Roberts' big picture was stuck down the basement of Parliament House in an open area near the post office, and it looked like it wasn't going to live for much longer, but obviously it survived and has been revamped. But tell us about that period, because as you point out, the Commonwealth Arts Advisory Board ends in 1973, which coincides with the election of the Whitlam Labor government, so it survives close to a decade beyond Menzies, but it doesn't survive beyond the coalition. What's the reason for the dismemberment of that and the creation of something in its place?
Nugget Coombs, who advised Whitlam, he disliked Bill Dargie particularly, but he was immensely controlling. My then husband, Clifton Pugh, was invited in the early 70s by Clyde Holding, who was leader of the opposition in Victoria, to form an arts policy committee because the performing artists, not the visual artists, were very unhappy with the then McMahon government's, I think, policies about the performing arts. Coombs had set it up so that he was chair of the Elizabethan Theatre Trust, and if you wanted to donate for a play or to have particularly a play or any performance of anything, you had to give money. The only way to get a tax deduction was to give money to the Elizabethan Theatre Trust, but you couldn't say where you wanted the money to go. So that meant that there was very little support, corporate or other, for artists, writers such as David Williamson, and all that group of people who were producing what are now really regarded as quite staid plays. So there was that difficulty to start with. In a sense, I forgive Nugget Coombs because he was a teacher. He taught in a country school, and he and Jean Baspi, who was always his sidekick, had an idea that the arts should be elevated. They were actually the people who were really not interested in Australian culture. They were interested in culture as a sort of way of improving the morals of a community. And so they didn't want the colloquial. They didn't want a record, the culture in which we live, to be vital and producing work. They wanted people to go and listen to classical opera and to Shakespeare and Shakespearean plays. I mean, there's no objection to this, but there was no assistance. So they developed a policy. It went through the federal conference, and at that time Don Dunson said to me that if I wanted anything done in the visual arts, I had to persuade the Treasurer or the Prime Minister had to become Minister for the Arts, because only their budgets were protected during pre-budget discussions. So nobody ever fought with them. So I thought, well, obviously Jim Cairns wasn't the person to go to, so I went to Whitlam, Cliff was painting him, and I won't go into the details, but he wasn't interested. He said, oh no, I don't want to be Minister for the Arts, why would I want to do that? And I said, well, I can show you, it'll be a help. And I ran it, well, I will, I'll tell you, I ran a campaign so that I was on his principal private secretary's campaign committee. Race Matthews was standing for Casey, where we lived. And so Race would tell me Race would actually put out an announcement as to a particular part of the arts policy, and I would have a journalist in each state, sitting in each capital city, sitting beside an artist of note who would turn to the journalists and say, oh, that sounds like a good idea. And so it began to look, it was fascinating, it looked as though that these policies were really accepted by artists. Quite interesting, at the first I couldn't get anyone who was employed. I had to use painters and sculptors and so on, and dance band leaders from the Musicians' Union. Anybody in employment could not afford to risk saying that they would vote Labour. And then gradually, it was very interesting because I got telephone calls saying, I'll be on board, just tell me what to say. Never leaked. No, it was never a story for anyone to write this. People just came aboard. And one day, I got a telephone call from Bobby Lim. Anybody of a certain age will remember that he was a sort of daytime TV show host, and everybody in his audience had sort of purple hair. And I knew then that the Labour Party would win at that point. If Bobby Lim was prepared to risk it, then we would win.
Right.
So I'm sorry. And then Nugget Coombs, we didn't realise, but Nugget Coombs was talking to Whitlam in Canberra. And Whitlam's father was a public servant. He believed in public servants. To our horror, when he got in, he suddenly started, he moved Nugget Coombs into the position that he'd been in and started giving Coombs the right to appoint people who had nothing to do with the arts but had always been around, you know. I mean, it's the only industry. When I went to live in the country, I met somebody on the Sheep Meat Council, and I said, oh, I might be interested in doing that, and he was absolutely appalled. But if you're an artist, you have to put up with the fact that you might get the president of the Sheep Meat Council, or you might get, you'll get a banker, you'll get somebody else on the board. They won't know anything about your industry. They won't have any expertise at all. But they'll be appointed, and artists and people with expertise don't get appointed. It's astonishing.
So, let's cut it out the back, John.
Thank you very much for the enlightening address. I just wondered whether you think, or what you think is the connection between Lindsay's interest in the visual arts and his
A question about the connection between Menzies' interest in the visual arts and his great interest in the movie camera.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think he was a man... My experience is that people learn in different ways. You know, I tend to hear things, but there are people who see things first. And I think Menzies was very acutely aware visually, probably genetically from his father, but also because I think his father would have trained him in the sense of constantly drawing his attention to detail and to representation. And so it's a natural thing when you can... He didn't try to paint or anything, but it's a natural thing when you can implement your talent and your interest to grab a camera.
Question here.
In asking this question, I should declare a certain self-interest. I'm a member of the National Cultural Heritage Committee, which gives advice to the Minister of the Arts about export of our cultural heritage, that is, that's movable.
Yeah.
I wonder in your research whether you've found any discussions and evidence that there was a concern about export of our finest works overseas.
I didn't see anything. I actually was interested and I didn't ever see anything about that. I mean, we were madly exporting in the sense of doing lots and lots of shows, but no, nobody seemed to be thinking about it.
Protected Ned Kelly's armour and a few other things, but there was no discussion about any of the Streeton works, for example,
no.
In the country.
No.
Just stand in front of the microphone. Yeah.
Sorry.
So there's a question... here somewhere? Oh, there. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
It was absolutely fascinating, dear. Thank you very much. Now, you sort of skirted over a mention of the Vienna Biennale, which I found fascinating, and the comparison between what happened in 54 with, I think, 58. And I just wondered if it was possible to elaborate a bit.
Well, at the Venice Biennale in 1958... Because I think the public servant advising Menzies became very anxious. And so on seeing that it was possible to put an older... Well, that the British had sent sort of established people like Constable and then at the same time a younger artist. Generally, the Venice Biennale is only one person or a group that is working together or whatever. So on seeing that, his secretary put a lot of pressure on the board to go along with this idea. And I think, well, anyway, they decided that they would send the young Arthur Boyd with Arthur Streeton. Now, you remember I said that at the time there was this huge debate in combat in the arts between the Americans promoting modernism or modernist work and the Soviets promoting socialist realism. So we sent a group of these two artists' works across to Venice, and Bernard Smith, and this particular public servant was very anxious, very anxiously anti-communist, constantly advising Menzies in when he was dealing with the literature board, the possibility of people having communist tendencies. So we sent early Boyds and Streetons. And when Bill Dargie made his report, he said that he went through about 14 pavilions, all of which were abstract. And then he came to the Australian pavilion. And he said that when the attendant said to him that if he liked this work, he might also like the Russian, Hungarian and Romanian pavilions. It would be hard to overstate how right he was. So we inadvertently put ourselves into the socialist realism stream.
Right, question here, and then down the back.
Judith, you mentioned hiding briefly.
Yeah.
Why does the Heidi modernism story affect Menzies' reputation?
Right, so there's a question about Heidi, but perhaps you should background Heidi, right?
Yes. John and Sunday Reed, children of exceedingly wealthy and influential people, John from Tasmania, and Sunday was a bailiff, married and went to live in Heidi, where they supported modern artists, both financially and by encouragement. And they donated Nolan's first series of pictures to the Australian National Gallery. They were fabulous. John ran the Contemporary Art Society. They did an enormous amount of very successful publicity. And Heidi, they donated their own house and their collection to what is now the Heidi Gallery in Melbourne. Bert Tucker also spent a lot of time being interviewed by Richard Hasey, whose wonderful book outlines a lot of the sort of mad, hilarious, really very funny debates in Victoria at the time, in Melbourne particularly at the time. Because of the romance of these two and because of the amount of money that's been poured into it, that's where the focus goes. These particular modern artists had difficulty getting bought. It is my view that the main reason is that not just that the Reeds were bohemian and deliberately sort of challenging the establishment, because there was a fair bit of bohemianism around and artists weren't the enemies. John Reed says at one stage that if you had long hair and a red tie, then it was very hard to get over an idea. Well, of course, maybe don't wear the long hair or red tie. But in fact, Sunday took as lovers not only Sidney Nolan, but the journalist Sam Attio, or the painter and journalist Sam Attio, and the journalist Michael Keon. And it turns out, very, very carefully researched, I mean, I'd heard this, but a lot of people have said in interview, including these three, that in fact John Reed liked to watch people making love to his wife. Now, it was a small town. And I think, you know, it's one thing to challenge conservatives. There was a sort of discreet acceptance of adultery or whatever. But even now, in Paris, that would be discussed. And I actually think that's really one of the main reasons why the narrative becomes enormously important and why there was just no, we won't go there about those pictures for a very long time.
Yes.
Some have said that Ms. Reed was a very generous supporter of artists. Particularly artists in need. Now, we're getting close to the end here. There's a question down there. Yeah.
Did you discover who people were, who benefactors who funded the big picture?
Did you discover who the benefactors were who funded the big picture?
No, well, I think it's known, but it wasn't my particular interest. There's a book, lovely book, on the exhibition building in Melbourne, and as the big picture was painted, there's quite a big essay on it. You could have a look there. David Dunstan.
Now, remind me, the big picture's ended up in the National Gallery.
Yeah, no, the big picture is in the Parliament.
It's still in the Parliament.
Yeah, but it's in its own beautiful place with a sort of a grotto.
They've taken out the old basement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Resurrection, yes. Joe.
Can you explain why the Tate Show so affects Menzies' reputation?
The question is, why does the Tate Show so affect Menzies' reputation?
Well, again, Bert Tucker was furious at not being selected. I mean, this is a really point at which things were changing. Menzies, and I think most of the Tate Board, expected a sort of survey show. They wanted more modern. He was happy to have modern at the end, but he wanted a proper survey show. It's a long meeting. They agreed. And then Bert Tucker discovered he only had a couple of pictures in it and went off his head. And he was a very, very aggressively articulate man, and a lot of the other artists followed. So there was actually a lot of fuss at the time. And then this has been analysed again by a couple of people who, because Menzies was keen on Streeton, then say that, you know, this was about having a particular image of Australia. I don't believe that to be true. And I think it was really a sort of a storm in a teacup. And the Tate Show, well, for instance, this woman who writes, she's written a PhD about it, says that nothing happened in Australian art, in London, after the Tate Show for Australian artists. Well, that wasn't so. Numbers of them were showing there robustly. And there was a bit of a controversy, yes, but I think it was nothing nothing happened as bad as it should. Menzies said, I was involved in this, and so everybody thought, well, how dare you? What he was involved with was actually meeting with the Tate to convince them to have the show.
So we're getting close to the end now. Have I missed anyone? No. Okay, can I... Oh, here's one question. Yeah?
It's of interest to me to know, I presume the National Art Gallery has a handle on where all this important art is and controlling its movements. Has anything of major interest gone missing? We're still looking for it.
The question is, have anything of major interest in the art collection in Australia gone missing?
The only interesting thing I've sort of noticed is that in all of the contracts of the early portraits, you were supposed to do a little head just to show, you know, that you had the person down pat. And somehow or other they're not in any collection that I can see. But otherwise, no. There was a catalogue and people kept lists.
So let's go back to where we start. I mean, I taught for 3 years at La Trobe University 4 decades ago, and so, and I know that PhDs are judged externally by and large, but my question is it possible to get awarded a PhD at La Trobe University if you don't think Menzies is a fascist?
My question too.
We will find out, folks, and we'd love to have Judith Pugh back sometime. But for tonight, I'd just like to say thanks for our speech. It was a beautifully written speech and a very informative speech. And what we like in Sydney is someone saying something that's different and hasn't been heard of before or hasn't been heard of for a long time. And this is a quite different interpretation. We had one interpretation about music during the Menzies period, which was quite a different interpretation from what you normally hear, and now one about the visual arts, again, quite different. So we're very grateful for you coming here tonight. Anne will love to publish your paper in the Sydney Papers Online. It'll be on our podcast tomorrow morning and for tonight, and we'll love to have you back sometime. I've no doubt this will probably finish up in a book somewhere.
I hope so.
And when it does, come back and tell us about it. But for tonight, thank you and well done.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.